Observatory, straight on the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they are, have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, heard of it. Self-consciously mocks that lineage, but
he's so that's happening. Okay.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Last week, Pope Francis issued a statement to Catholics worldwide, something that's called an apostolic exhortation. In more than 100 pages, he talks about how to live a holy life in, quote, a practical way for our time. The document covers many things, but the newspaper headline singled out this in particular, that caring for the poor and for refugees is a vital Catholic duty, just as vital in Francis's eyes as opposing abortion. That shift in the Church's priorities has made Pope Francis quite popular, especially here in the United States, but it's led to some hostility and real resistance to the Pope from more conservative Catholics. It's a resistance that we haven't seen in generations. And one of those critics is the conservative New York Times columnist Ross Douthat. For Douthat, Francis is hardly the kindly reformer. Rather, he's a radical, playing fast and loose with doctrine. In a new book called To Change the Church, Douthat claims that Francis is, frankly, a deep danger to Catholicism, and he goes so far as to compare him to Donald Trump, which, to be clear, Ross Douthat does not mean as a compliment. So, Ross, you've written a book that's a critique of an enormously popular pope, at least in the United States, and when people ask you, what have you got against Pope Francis, what's your immediate response?
Embarrassment, cringing embarrassment, sort of, you know, a desperate desire to escape the conversation. But then I say to myself, well, I wrote a book about this, so I guess I have to actually answer the question. No, Pope Francis has a well-earned, I think, reputation as the great liberal pope, which manifests itself in sort of his emphases, the fact that he talks, you know, more about migration and poverty and those kind of issues than about the sort of what we think of as culture war issues in the West, abortion and same-sex marriage and euthanasia and so on. And I'm some kind of a conservative Catholic, I suppose. So there's at least a mild tension between sort of his general vision for the church and my general politics and so on.
If he's talking about poverty.
Right.
Do you have a problem with that?
No.
So then let's get to the core of your difficulty.
Well, the core of it is that part of this liberalization – so the hope initially, I think, was that Francis would basically maintain this kind of synthesis that I think is one of the church's strengths between a vision of sort of social solidarity that tends to lean to the left in certain ways on economic questions and a vision of sort of what you might call moral solidarity that emphasizes the centrality of the family, that, you know, the protection of unborn human life and so on. And ultimately what Francis has decided to do instead, I think, is basically seek a kind of truce with post-sexual revolution culture. And he's done this sort of on this specific point that has involved bishops and theologians in complicated shouting matches in Rome over whether divorced and remarried Catholics can take communion without getting their first marriage annulled.
And you have a deep problem with, say, divorced Catholics taking communion?
Not divorced Catholics. Divorced Catholics can take communion. But I think that if the church makes this shift, it basically means that the church's claim to teach the indissolubility of marriage is sort of empty.
Well, before we get to these arguments, let's talk a little bit about you. You were not born to conservative Catholicism or Catholicism in general, right?
No, I was raised in a lot of different strange places religiously. We started out as Episcopalians and then we ended up on a kind of wild tour, yeah, of American evangelicalism, Pentecostalism, all kinds of charismatic Christianity. And then we ended up becoming Catholic when I was about 16. So I'm this little-known third category, neither adult convert nor cradle Catholic. But when I came in, John Paul II was Pope, and he sort of seemed to be offering a kind of synthesis, which basically said, look, the church changed in various ways in the 1960s with the Second Vatican Council, changed its attitude towards liberal democracy, changed its relationship with Judaism. But for the sake of the church's own continuity, it also has sort of maintained its resistance to a lot of the trends that came in after Vatican II, the divorce culture, sexual revolution generally.
What does that mean, the divorce culture? Why would a church want to get rid of, rather than bring into its fold, people whose marriages, for one reason or another, have collapsed?
I mean, I think the idea is not that the church wants to get rid of anybody. The idea is that the church is trying to be faithful to a particular moral vision in which marriage is actually something that you are supposed to do and can really only do once if it's a real marriage. And that vision, I mean, I think it's you know, there's a theological case for it, but there's also a sociological argument here, which is that the idea of a welcoming church, it can have an effective cruelty toward the people who are victims of the kind of individualistic sexual culture that you have now. So if you say, you know, well, for the sake of mercy, we're going to essentially act as if second marriages are the same as first marriages, that says something to the children of the first marriage who are now told that actually the church, which was sort of the last entity saying that your parents' first marriage was a real marriage and it was the real marriage and, you know, that this is something that should have been held together, that's gone.
Jesus was living in a time when life expectancies were rather shorter than they are now.
Somewhat.
Although
if you survived childhood, they weren't actually.
They were a hell of a lot shorter. And you're pretty young. Let's say.
Relatively.
How old are you?
I'm 38. I'm getting up there.
Pretty damn young. If God forbid, in 10 years, for some reason, your marriage went off the rails and you were to remarry, what would be the effect on you as a Catholic of not taking communion?
I mean,
wouldn't you feel a great sense of loss?
I think ideally, I wouldn't remarry, right? That I, you know, and of course, life is long and God knows what would happen. But I think I would have to have some larger intellectual change in my relationship to the faith in order to convince myself that it was right to remarry in the first place. Which is, again, yeah, it's an extreme sounding.
So you would disavow sex for the rest of your life?
I mean, I think it's companionship more than sex that would be the challenging part.
Well, they both would be challenging.
They both would be challenging. But again, this is where, you know, in what Catholicism has traditionally taught, right, is that, in fact, celibacy is the highest form of the Christian life and that marriage is there for people who, you know, aren't up for celibacy, which is most of us. But I don't think the idea that God could ask you to be celibate for the last 30 years of your life is an impossible ask given the asks that are made of Christians in all kinds of complicated situations that don't have anything to do with sex and relationships and so on. I think a Catholicism that can't ask people to be celibate is a Catholicism that in the end isn't going to have much of a compelling claim on people at all. For the Catholic message to make sense, you have to be able to make a case that celibacy is possible for people who aren't married.
So it's no secret to you that your views on women's rights are frequently criticized. You've argued that access to contraception and abortion gives women a degree of choice in the matter of becoming a parent that's kind of unfair to men. I think I'm getting this right. And in the end, that's fundamentally detrimental to society.
Oh, I don't know that I've said that precisely. Unfair to men?
What's your beef with contraception? Start with that.
I don't have an incredibly strong beef with contraception. I think that there's a kind of contraceptive mentality that alienates people from family. I think abortion should be restricted because abortion is a form of murder, but that's different. I mean, if anything, I think in many cases the sort of post-sexual revolution culture is beneficial for a certain kind of man in striking ways. Part of the sexual revolution is Gloria Steinem, but part of the sexual revolution is Hugh Hefner or Harvey Weinstein. I think there are ways in which men can be the losers from this culture insofar as it sort of, you know, deprives them of sort of clear roles. But I don't think it's anything as simple as like men have lost from the sexual revolution and women have gained.
You wrote in a column that people who are in support of current abortion laws are themselves extremists.
Yes.
Why am I an extremist?
American abortion laws are themselves rather extreme by the standards of much of the Western world. Generally, since Roe v. Wade, America has had one of the more permissive abortion regimes where second and third trimester abortions are concerned relative to France or Italy or Germany or, you know, other sort of peer countries. So in that sense, the sort of default pro-choice position is more extreme in its willingness to accept killing unborn life. That's sort of the easy
answer. Is a woman who gets an abortion a murderer?
She's a particular kind of murderer, yes, in a sense.
What kind?
A kind who has committed she's committed an act of killing that is intentional and ends a human life.
What should be the penalty?
I don't think there should be any penalty for a woman who gets an abortion. I think the law should restrict and penalize doctors and others who abortionists who perform abortions. But I think the
The restriction be?
The restriction should be it should be against the law to perform abortion, and there should be some jail time for abortionists.
Now you know damn well what's coming next, and then we return to the back alley and the close hanger. And
do we? I mean, this is where I think there's sort of an insufficient level of actual study. And I think there's no question that if you look at countries in the developing world that have restrictions on abortion, you end up with lots of, back alley abortions and a general climate that can be terrible for women. I think if you look at countries, though, in the Western world that have abortion restrictions, Ireland is a country that has had a ban on abortion since its inception as a republic. And Ireland has very strong statistics when it comes to gender equity, maternal mortality, and so on. The pro-life movement is sort of stuck in certain ways because it's ended up united to the Republican Party, which takes a sort of hostile view of social spending, obviously.
Right. The argument is that that the very same people who are the most ferocious, I'm not talking about you, but just in general, most ferocious on anti-abortion are also the least likely to be pro-spending on all kinds of social programs.
Which isn't always the case. And especially, again, within Catholicism, I mean, historically, prior to Roe v. Wade, many people who are now pro-life Catholic Republicans were pro-life Catholic Democrats. And there's a fairly strong tradition in Catholicism. That's not the Republican Party right now. The Republican Party can drift in that direction. Compassionate conservatism was sort of an attempt to move in that direction.
At one point in the book, you compare Pope Francis, of all people, to Donald Trump. And you write this: the Pope has turned out to be far more Trumpian than most of the cardinals who elected him ever anticipated. Francis's opponents, like Trump's, feel that they're resisting an abnormal leader, a man who does not respect the rules that are supposed to bind his office. Meanwhile, to his supporters, all these discontents are vindication, evidence that he's bringing about the change required to make Catholicism great again.
Yeah, I mean, that's a deliberate provocation to some extent. But obviously, there's no moral comparison between the two men. Whatever my criticisms of Pope Francis. But in their relationship to their institutions, there are real similarities.
Ross, this is one point of yours that I'm not getting at all. Pope Francis, as opposed to his predecessor, Benedict, and as opposed to John Paul and the rest, there are shades of difference. But you're portraying Francis as radically, radically different, as different as Trump is to his predecessor somehow.
Well,
I don't see that.
In Catholicism, you don't get, Francis has put himself in a position where conservatives and traditionalists can, at the very least, raise questions and say, you're flirting with heresy. And that's a very unusual thing. For a very unusual situation for a pope to find himself in. Maybe it's not as unusual as electing, a billionaire populist, libertine as president of the United States. But on the other hand, we've only had 40-odd presidents and we've had 2,000 years of popes. And there are really very few cases where popes got into the kind of situation that Francis has gotten in, the kind of controversy.
Now, one area where I would assume, Ross, you differ from your more liberal Catholic brethren is on questions of, say, Islam and immigration. You've been very conservative, it seems to me, on immigration, and you've been very tough on Islam.
Because
it seems to me that somebody like Pope Francis, for example, on immigration, sees it as a focus for the need for compassion.
Yep.
That you have enormous hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people forced to flee, and they're refugees. And
I mean, I've argued that it's very risky for Europe to have any kind of open door to refugees right now. Yeah,
your compassion seems not as nearly as generous as the Pope. And how do you answer that?
I think the Pope might. It's totally possible that the Pope is closer to the heart of the Christian message on immigration than I am. I mean, anytime you set out to be critical of the Pope as a Catholic, you
is
need
that a
to be
failing of yours
open.
Or the Pope's?
Oh, it would be, if it's true, it's a failing of mine. It's a sign that I am sort of privileging pragmatic concerns and doubts about Europe's stability over a kind of, more radical vision of love. And I could be, it could be a case where my sort of conservative temperament has led me away from the Gospels. At the same time, I think it's a mistake for liberalism, sort of abstracting from the sort of more radical question of what Christian love requires. It's a mistake for liberalism to sort of assume that, the job of the statesman is to just assume that, nativists can be crushed and you don't have to deal with the reality of nativism. The good statesman has to deal with the reality that large-scale population change in a swift time produces backlash, and you want to be, therefore, be careful and prudent. There's a sense in which I can see that the Pope might be right and I might be wrong. On the other hand, it's tricky to say that, a Christian statesman would be one who would make choices that might end up balkanizing his own country and sort of destroying its internal stability.
Conservatism has had a long history in the United States, and you have written pretty forcefully about the pervasive influence of right-wing talk radio and its influence on contemporary conservatism, which is far harsher, far more filled with all the things that we associate with Rush Limbaugh and now Fox, so the harsher aspects of Fox, which are plenty. How do you go about getting rid of that? If that stuff makes you sick,
I mean,
how is the culture of conservatism going to right itself?
I mean, this may sound like a sort of ridiculous answer, but I actually think the way the culture of conservatism, it probably only can be fixed to some extent from the top down. Well, put it this way. I think the people who supported Trump were wrong, but I think their theory that, that you needed a strong president who could redefine conservatism was actually correct.
What messiah are you waiting for?
There
is
no
in the earthly sense.
No. Well, you asked me about, what I think about conservatism. I have no optimism.
You're just asking
me how it, the only way it fixes itself, I think, is from the top. Somebody gets elected, governs well, and the party sort of conforms itself to their leadership.
That's what I'm asking you for.
I don't have a candidate.
There's no one on the horizon in the Republican Party.
No, at the moment, I don't see, I think you could sort of take pieces of Marco Rubio, pieces of Tom Cotton, pieces of Nikki Haley, fuse them together into some ideal candidate, but that's just make-believe. The figures we have right now, none of them have shown the capacity to be the leader that conservatism needs to be a good force for the common good in our society right now.
Ross, thank you so much.
Sure, you're very welcome.
Ross Douthat is a columnist for The New York Times, and his new book is called To Change the Church, Pope Francis and the Future of Catholicism. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. Coming up, Major League Baseball versus the minor leagues. That's in a minute. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Baseball season is, thank goodness, and after long months of cold, in full swing. For minor league players, far from the big stadiums and the TV screens, the famously bad pay and working conditions just got a little harder, thanks to the federal government. Tucked away in the spending bill, the giant 2,000-plus-page omnibus bill, is something called the Save America's Pastime Act. We can probably assume that many of the people who voted on the tax cuts never even read the Save America's Pastime Act. But it seems to specifically exempt the league from paying minor league ballplayers according to the federal minimum wage. Mary Pallon is a sports writer who's been trying to figure it all out. And one of the people she spoke with is a lawyer named Garrett Brushhouse. Brushhouse practices litigation in St. Louis, and he's representing minor league players in a suit for better pay. He himself spent 6 years playing in the minor leagues before going into law. Here's Mary Pallon.
I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, which is about 6 hours away from the nearest pro baseball team, the Mariners. So minor league baseball, I went all the time to see the Eugene Emeralds play. And it was a huge part of not just my childhood, but kind of how I accessed sports. And it was affordable for the family to go. There were, for not that much money, you could sit pretty close. The players spent a lot of time, you know, signing autographs for kids and stuff. So I spent a lot of time watching minor league baseball. Garrett, did you watch minor league baseball growing up too?
So I grew up in an area that was so country that we didn't even have a minor league baseball team close to us. So I did not grow up going to minor league baseball games. I grew up in Southeast Missouri. But, you know, you'd mentioned Eugene, Oregon. That was one of the first places that I played in my minor league career.
So you were drafted by the San Francisco Giants right out of college. Did you know you were going to spend time in the minors after you were drafted?
Oh, without a doubt. Everybody goes through the minors at least for a little bit. And most guys spend several years in the minor leagues. So it's a prerequisite where you have to play in the minors really before you go to the major leagues.
Can you quickly explain the relationship between the minor leagues and Major League Baseball, which is the professional baseball organization I think most people are more familiar with?
Major League Baseball has long had this farm system in place. And the reason it's called a farm system is it's the leagues where they cultivate the young players and they turn them into, the major league players eventually. And, the important thing is that the major league teams are the ones that pay the players, and they also hire the minor league coaches. And so it's Major League Baseball and its teams that always control, where the players play and how much they're paid. And then the minor league teams, the minor league owners, are really just in charge of selling tickets.
Can you give us a basic description of how a minor league player is paid, whether that's salaried or by the hour, kind of how that works?
So to start with, the salaries are only paid during the season. Spring training just wrapped up for minor league players. They weren't paid at all during that spring training time. So it was a full month of work where, they were required to work 60, 70 hours per week and weren't paid at all for that. Then once the season actually begins, that's when their salaries begin. The starting salary for first-year players is $1,100 per month right now. Each level that you go up, and there are several different levels in the minor leagues. There's rookie ball, which is the lowest level, and then it goes on up to single A, and then double A and triple A. And each level, your salary increases a little bit, but there are still, several players in triple A baseball that were only making around $2,200 per month. So on a given night, if you go to a double A baseball game, whether it's in Hartford, Connecticut, or in Frisco, Texas, there might be 7,000-8,000 fans on a given night seeing that player. But they make so little per hour that, when I was playing, it wasn't uncommon for the bat boy to be making more than the guy playing first base.
How do you make ends meet with all of that?
Well, it's very difficult. I had a Venezuelan teammate that was my catch partner, and we did our running together, we did our throwing together, and I was talking to him, and he had a pregnant fiance back home, and he was just trying to save up $20 a month to send back to her, and he was having a hard time doing that. And one of my teammates, we'd be on the long bus rides, and all of a sudden he's getting a call from the debt collector that's trying to come after him. So some guys are lucky enough to be drafted in very early rounds and they get a signing bonus that helps them out. They live on that throughout their minor league career. My fiance and then wife often paid our first month's deposit on our apartment each year. She helped me through spring training for sure. early on in your career, you have so much euphoria that, you know, you'd run through a brick wall for that organization. And so you don't think about the financial strife at all. But then the bills don't go away. And after a few years, you know, a lot of guys do start realizing that I can't make ends meet doing this.
So now one of your cases is representing minor league players in this lawsuit against Major League Baseball. Talk to us about why minor league players are suing baseball and how this all came together.
So all we're doing is we're just trying to apply this country's just basic minimum wage laws to minor league baseball players. If Major League Baseball expects these players, you know, to work 60 hours per week during spring training, then they should be paid for that work. But for some reason, Major League Baseball, for years now, has decided they don't want to pay salaries during spring training. And then even during the season, we're saying that if you're going to require them to work 60 hours per week, then you need to comply with our country's basic wage laws and provide them a livable wage. They tried defending it by arguing that they were basically like apprentices or like interns. You know, they're temporary employees that are there just to learn. That's a, you know, very offensive defense for a minor league player. You know, a minor league player is signed to a 7-year contract, and so that gives the major league team the exclusive rights to the players for that 7-year period. And so to say that they aren't even employees covered by your basic minimum wage laws, you know, it's quite offensive to minor league players. If Walmart and McDonald's can figure out a way to comply with our basic wage laws, then surely Major League Baseball can do it as well.
So tucked into the spending bill on page 1,967, I believe, was the Save America's Pastime Act, which dealt with this very issue. Talk to us a little bit about what exactly this provision of the spending bill would do, or I guess now does, and how did you catch wind of it?
What it does is it basically provides a new exemption where if Major League Baseball just pays the minimum wage based on a 40-hour work week, then they gain an exemption from the minimum wage laws. Our country's just our federal basic minimum wage law. And, you know, when you do the math, 725 times 40, it's a little less than $1,200 per month then, whenever you average it out over a month. And so the way I'm sure Major League Baseball will interpret this is they will interpret this as allowing them to continue to not pay minor league players anything during spring training and during the offseason. As far how it came about, there was no hearing, there was no committee vote, there was no debate at all. Instead, what happened is the very top of leadership, you know, Mitch McConnell, Paul Ryan, they had been lobbied hard by MLB's lobbyist. MLB paid over $1.3 million each of the past 2 years to lobbyists and paid a lot more to campaign contributions. And this was a powerful lobbying group that was close to leadership, and they succeeded in getting this secretly tucked in to a spending bill, even though it has nothing to do with spending at all.
Yeah, in my reporting, it was still unclear to me how exactly this provision ended up in the spending bill. I called various offices of various representatives of Congress, the majority, the minority leaders, all around, and I still couldn't quite figure out how exactly this made it into the spending bill, particularly when it doesn't directly deal with government spending. Why is the federal government weighing in on paying minor league baseball players at all in a spending bill?
That beats me. You know, if there's ever been anything misnamed in this world, this would be it. It has nothing to do with saving America's pastime at all. It is making more money than it ever has before. It's seen exponential revenue growth. And, you know, the profit margins are huge, both in Major League Baseball and in Minor League Baseball.
Wow. So how does it change your case? Is the case dead? Is it unclear? Where does that put the lawsuit?
Well, the case certainly isn't dead. One of the things about the wage and hour laws is, you know, states are allowed to enact higher minimum wages, and they're also free to say that they aren't going to have all the exemptions that the federal law has. there will be some state laws we can continue to rely on, and we'll continue to pursue that, and we'll continue to push forward. And you know, hopefully at the end of the day, fairness will win out, and hopefully at the end of the day, Major League Baseball will decide to do the right thing, and you know, instead of spending money on lobbyists, hopefully they'll increase salaries.
But I also wonder, you know, how will the league survive if people aren't being paid a living wage? And if minor league baseball fell apart or crumbled in some way, what would that mean for Major League Baseball?
Well, Major League Baseball wouldn't exist without the minor leagues. You know, the way Major League Baseball is set up, they often draft players as young as 16 out of the Dominican Republic and out of Venezuela. And even out of the United States, they draft 18-year-old high school players. Well, if you're 16, if you're 18, you certainly aren't ready for Major League Baseball. And so those are the guys that we're fighting for.
That was attorney Garrett Brushhouse, a former minor league ball player, and he was talking with contributor Mary Pilon. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
I'm happy to say I had never been in a surgical theater before. I've never undergone surgery myself, and I've never witnessed a surgery as a journalist before, and I'm quite squeamish.
That's Rebecca Mead, who's been a staff writer at The New Yorker for more than 20 years. In December, Rebecca sat in on a surgery, and it was 7 hours long. What she observed was miraculous, but some of it's a little difficult to hear about, so heads up or stomach down.
It's a little after 7:30 in the morning, and we're in the operating room. There is an iPhone plugged in, and throughout the operation, this will be playing music, mostly Britpop from the 1960s. Abby is in a violet-colored surgical gown, and she's lying on the operating table. She's sedated, she's on a respirator. The first incision is just under the chin. Dr. Deschamps Brawley makes a small cut there and proceeds to reduce her Adam's apple.
I just want to mention that we've altered Abby's voice at her request to help protect her privacy.
The first time I talked to Abby, it was on Skype in the fall of 2017. Hi, how are you?
Hey, good.
Yeah, likewise. It's seeing her on the screen, she looked very attractive. She was very pretty and very feminine looking. She has these incredible eyes. Her features are strong. She's a very striking looking person. And she told me that she was quite happy with the way that she looked face on. But the problems she felt were more visible when she turned her head to the side. And she showed me that when she turned her head, it was much more possible to see the protrusion on her brow above her eyes and the Adam's apple in her throat bulging. And those were the things that made her really unhappy with her appearance.
But with something like facial features, those are chiefly defined by the size and proportions of the bones, you know, your facial bones. Mm-hmm. Developments during puberty for me that I can't undo.
Abby had been taking hormone replacement therapy for months by the time I first talked to her. And it had had some major effects on her appearance. Her skin was much softer. She'd taken other steps towards transitioning socially. She changed her name legally. And she told me that in the summer of 2017, she'd finally crossed an invisible line whereby she was more often addressed by a feminine pronoun than by a masculine one. And yet, there were still things about her face that she was deeply unhappy with.
It's all those extremely subtle cues that when you meet someone for the first time, you know, the fraction of a second, and that's what informs you of who this person is, how they should be addressed. And one of the ways that the world chiefly interacts with you is by your face, right, is by looking at you.
So she's naturally a very outgoing person, a very friendly person, an open person. But she became more withdrawn, and there were even things about her mannerisms that changed. She told me that she no longer wanted to turn her head, because when she did that, her Adam's apple bulged out. So instead of turning to look at something, she would just flick her eyes to the left or to the right, and she would keep her chin tucked down. She demonstrated for me, and she looked like she was an actor playing a character in a Jane Austen movie. And I think that for her, she became more self-conscious and less social and less willing to make eye contact with others because she felt that she was going to be judged or evaluated or wondered about.
I'm just very, very aware of how much visibility there is for our community out right now, which is really great. But also, at least in my opinion, I think it makes it harder, a little bit harder for trans individuals just to go about their daily lives. In the past, you would walk down the street and kind of view somebody as just being, oh, you know, that person's atypical or looks, you know, just a little, you know, unique or something like that. And now I think there's just more scrutiny to really trying to like, is that one of the people that I've heard about in the news or I've read about? Is that one of them? Or, you know, it's kind of voyeuristic and we don't want that attention.
Abby isn't her real name. She's very security-minded. She's aware that there is a disproportionate amount of violence committed against trans people. For her, she wants to be able to move through the world without drawing attention to her gender. And a friend of hers had had what's called facial feminization surgery, and had been very pleased with the results. And so Abby started to look into it for herself. And she's a teacher of biology, and she could really understand what the procedures that she would be undergoing were. Dr. Deschamps Brawley is a craniofacial surgeon and is trained in repairing faces that are deformed by congenital abnormalities or even by accidents. And he trained under a surgeon named Douglas Osterhout, who in the 1980s was a pioneer of facial feminization techniques and chose Dr. Deschamps Brawley as his successor. There's a light board that has Abby's x-rays up on it and schematic drawings that the surgeon has done to show him where, you know, a millimeter needs to come off here and 2 millimeters here. And there are also these photographs that are taken of Abby, digitally altered pictures of her as he is aiming to have her be 6 months from now.
And I'll take a small mill label.
By 8:35, he has finished with the tracheal shave and moves on to her brow and cuts into her face just below the hairline. Quick slice down one side, sort of down the hairline, then behind her ear, and then another cut on the other side. And this is the point at which, if you're a listener who is squeamish, be warned. He starts to peel her forehead away from her skull. It looks like peeling the skin of a mango away from the flesh of a mango. So there's this kind of fleshy flap that is coming down and exposing the bone beneath. This is the point at which the whole thing starts to feel rather like a science fiction movie. Having been terrified that I was going to be a puddle on the floor, I was completely riveted. Her forehead is now being lifted off her scalp and folded down over her eyes. Dr. Deschamps Brawley looks at the images on the wall and takes out a little pencil and draws the shape of the planned incision on her bone. You know, a typical masculine forehead has a much more pronounced brow ridge than a typical feminine forehead. He uses something called a reciprocating saw to cut away a piece of bone. He lifts it off and cuts this piece of bone into four and then reshapes it, ties these pieces back together with stainless steel wires, and then puts it back in her forehead and flaps her face back up over it, smooths it down and sort of eyeballs it just to see how it looks.
Cool. All right. So, let me show you a washy wash. Let's change gloves and we'll do the reconstruction.
Is it or is it not a kind of beautification surgery? Is that the wrong way to think about it?
To an extent, it is a little bit of beautification, but only because I think our society tends to view more typically feminine faces as being more beautiful. Mm-hmm. There's definitely an aspect to the surgeries that have to do with that, but my motivations just aren't cosmetic. My motivations aren't superficial for it. It's to relieve, you know, dysphoria, to help the world see me as who I am.
So gender dysphoria is a clinically recognized condition, best understood as a severe dislocation between one's inward sense of self and one's outward appearance. The difference between ordinary dissatisfaction with what you see in the mirror and genuine gender dysphoria is the difference between not really liking your thighs and feeling like your thighs do not belong to you, that these are not your thighs.
You have this really strong mental image of what you look like, how you act, everything, just this kind of like sum total, you know, your mental image of yourself. And then when you look in the mirror or look at your face or something, it projects like the extreme opposite of that mental view of yourself. You can feel like just extremely intense and extremely negative emotions, you know, anger, frustration, depressed and angry and upset, and usually it's all at once and they roll together and roll from one to the next. And it's completely debilitating, completely crippling.
So after the surgery, what do you hope to see when you look in the mirror?
Myself.
This is a really long surgery, 7 hours in total. And around 11:30, Dr. De Chambrolli takes a break, goes down to the hospital cafeteria and grabs himself a Coke and a packet of peanut butter crackers. By noon, he's back in the operating room. Abby has quite a strong lower jaw. He opens her mouth wide and cuts the flesh that connects her cheek to where her teeth are. He calls me over to take a look. I can see her skeleton, and he's cutting away the bone of her jaw with a reciprocating saw. It's quite forceful. He tapers her jaw, and then he gets to the middle, which is her chin, and then excises this T-shaped piece. It's quite a large piece of bone that gets pulled out, and it's like watching a piece of gristle being pulled out of a meat pie. There's a specially designed little piece of metal, like a little bracket, that joins the bits of bone together and cinches them together so that the chin is smaller. Five weeks after the operation, I went to see Abby at home.
It's in a biohazard bag.
She'd kept the bone as a memento.
Plastic container. It's like my sticker with my ID on it. it still blows my mind that they were able to go cut all this out, take it all out, sew it back up, and everything's fine.
When I saw her, she just started back at work. She had told a few close colleagues what she was doing, but for the most part, she told anybody who asked or needed to know that what she had undergone was a corrective surgery. She was a little self-conscious about the swelling in her face, although to my eye, it really didn't look very swollen at all, given what I'd seen her go through.
It is amazing to see you, because you look, it's so, I mean, it's just
what are your impressions? Incredible. I'm curious.
You look, well, you look lovely.
Thank you. I'm fishing for compliments.
Yeah, no, I know. Well, you look completely beautiful, obviously. But it's, I'm trying to find words for it. I mean, you look familiar and yet not the same. Yeah. I think you look more different than I thought you were going to.
Yeah.
So her whole face is very different. Although the changes, the actual surgical changes, can be counted in millimeters. The way that she holds herself has already changed.
You said to me before you had this done that you sometimes had these moments where you would see your reflection and then it made you unhappy to...
Yeah.
And I wonder whether you have that.
I haven't had that same experience since. It's just not there. I don't.
You know, other patients of Dr. Deschamps-Brolly, whom I'd interviewed, had told me that the experience of seeing themselves revealed for the first time when the bandages came off was incredibly emotional and moving. And one person told me that she had burst into tears. Abby did not have that experience. You know, finally, when she looked in the mirror, all the bandages were taken off and she looked at herself in the mirror. She thought, oh yeah, that's my face.
One of his medical team told me something really interesting. When they have cis patients, you know, non-trans patients, and they have some type of surgery done, you know, if you're in a car accident and you had to get your nose altered in some way or your chin or something changed, it just like takes time for you to kind of get over that mental image of who you were and now you're looking at your reflection and those two things aren't matching, so you start freaking out. They told me that really doesn't happen as much with their trans patients. It's just like, you're like, oh, cool. It's just, it's like over and done. Their trans patients just tend to just accept, you know, their quote unquote new face.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Rebecca Mead wrote about Abby and a lot more on the technique of facial feminization surgery. You can find her article at newyorker.com. We altered Abby's voice to help protect her privacy. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. Stick around. I'm David Remnick, and next week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, we have something very special lined up, an interview with James Comey. Comey has a new book about to come out, and there's going to be a lot to cover. The election, the Russia investigation, Hillary's emails, Donald Trump, and the future of Robert Mueller's investigation. I'll be talking with Comey live at Town Hall in New York, and you can hear it all the next day at newyorkerradio.org or wherever you listen to the show. Don't miss it. For today, we're going to close things up by getting outside with the poet Ada Limón. Limón grew up in California and then spent a long time living in New York City. Some years back, she left New York to live with her boyfriend, now her husband, in Lexington, Kentucky. Fewer rats, more horses.
Hey there.
This is Cactus.
A cactus.
Beautiful quarter horse.
You know why I call him Cactus?
What?
Where's his name?
Oh. Limón's last book was called Bright Dead Things, and it's all about adjusting to a new home, a new relationship, and the constant talk of thoroughbreds.
We're standing in front of the main
entrance here to Keeneland, and they've got this beautiful stone walls, and it kind of looks like a castle. Keeneland, I think, is one of the prettiest race courses in all of the United States. Now, this isn't where the Derby happens. Churchill Downs is where the Derby is raced, but Keeneland is a beautiful old track that has this very historic, stately feel in the middle of beautiful horse pastures all around it. It feels like spring might actually come. The sun's not quite up. It's a little cloudy. Being here when it's empty is kind of lovely. So right now we're walking through the main track area before we get to the actual racetrack. So this is where you have the concessions, where you get your popcorn and your Kentucky's burgoo, which is a sort of legendary Kentucky food. I'm not a huge fan, don't tell anyone. You get soft pretzels and popcorn and, you know, soft ice cream for the kids. And then as we keep walking up here, you'll see all of the betting windows. I grew up going to the track occasionally with my stepfather, who loves to play the ponies. But we would go to the Sonoma County Fair and go to the track out there. People always ask me, you know, what you have so many horses in your poems. What are they a metaphor for? And I think they're not really a metaphor. Like, out here, they're just horses. The very first time I came to Keeneland, it was here to meet Zenyatta, who is a famous filly who I just adore. She's famous for having won the Breeders' Cup Classic, the only filly to have won the Breeders' Cup Classic. And she was sort of a icon of mine, and so it was fun to get to meet her. And that was actually the very first time I came to Keeneland. I think one of the things I love about watching them race is the thrill that they seem to get from it. Like, they actually seem to be enjoying the race. So right now I'm looking at the main track, which is a dirt track. It has almost like a reddish quality. And it's loose dirt, even though we got some rain. It looks like it's bouncy. They try to keep it so it's healthy for the horses to run on. And then the track right behind it is the turf. Now, right now, we've got a thoroughbred going by, a thoroughbred racehorse. There's something about them that is so beautiful as they race. And as they just stand there in the pasture, and out in here in Kentucky, you know, they're about as common as birds. This area right here is the apron, and this is where, if you just pay general admission, you can come and sit and stand on the rail and root for your horse. On a busy day, it will just be packed and loud and ruckus. It's a great sound. I kind of like coming out here when there's no one here. It feels like there is some sort of ghost of energy within the space, as if it's, you could almost hear the echoes of roars. People screaming with joy because they actually won big for the first time. This is a poem I wrote for the Kentucky Oaks Day, which is when all the fillies race, and it's one of my favorite races. How to triumph like a girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy, like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger after winning. Ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies. As if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me.
that somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart. Giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge, beating, genius machine that thinks, no, it knows, it's going to come in first.
The poet Ada Limon at Keeneland Racecourse in Lexington, Kentucky. You can find the poem she's published in The New Yorker at newyorker.com. I'm David Remnick, and that's it for this week. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you'll join us next week with a conversation with former FBI Director James Comey.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Johnny Vince Evans, Corey Schreppel, Malik Baji, Jenny Cataldo, Michelle Moses, Emily Mann, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.